the New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.
Greetings and welcome along to the New Zealand Business Podcast. This is our special episode with David Hughes. Now, a real privilege for me to get to chat with David whilst in Silicon Valley. Now, I first met David about 15 years ago on a trip to the Valley where I was investigating starting a new business in the technology space. And it was great to spend some time with David then, and I was traveling with David's brother on that particular trip. But this time around, now we're sort of 10 or 15 years on from first meeting him, and boy, what a story he's got to tell. So we'll share that with you very shortly. First up, just a quick thank you to our two sponsors for this episode. Firstly, Guerrilla Technology. That's the company that I run. I'm the CEO and founder at Guerrilla. If you are needing help with how to leverage technology better within your business, then Guerrilla is the company to talk to, whether it's digital transformation, whether it's just how to be a bit more efficient and effective by better utilizing technology, or if you want to bring those old systems into the cloud, then feel free to get in touch, guerrillatechnology.com. And our second sponsor is Process Street. Process Street is an amazing online cloud-based platform for managing and documenting your business processes. We've been using it at Guerrilla for well over a year now, and what we've been able to do is a couple of things. One, just improve the consistency and quality of what we deliver in our services by having documented processes and checklists that are filled in electronically. We're not looking around for bits of paper. This is a really slick system. And also, as I've moved more away from the day-to-day operations of the business and become more strategic, it's allowed us to capture those processes that in the past were often quite reliant on me. So it's really freed me up a lot. So Process Street, really good tool. If you want to have a look at that, you can go to nztechpodcast.com/processstreet. That gives you access to a 10% for life discount should you buy it. And there's also a free version you can get as well. All right, well, let's jump into the chat with David Hughes.
Today we're talking with David Hughes, the founder and CEO at Silver Peak Systems in Silicon Valley, where we are today in Palo Alto at a shared working space. David, thank you very much for joining me.
Great to be here. Great to see you.
Now, you're probably the first Kiwi that I've talked to on the show who has spent the large majority, if not all, of your working life outside of New Zealand, and you're still based outside of New Zealand. But before we dive into what you're doing here, maybe you can run us through how you got, where you grew up, and sort of a little bit about that story, and where your initial interests in entrepreneurship came from.
Sure. So I was born and grew up in Auckland, where I spent the first 20 years of my life. When I was younger, I wanted to be an architect, as in designing houses. And then when I was about 11 or 12, I was introduced for the very first time to computers. Back in those days, it was like the TRS-80 and Apple II. And there was something about them that really fascinated me. And I began to become interested in that. And one thing led to another. I actually started doing contract programming back when I was 14, 15.
Oh, wow.
And I did have a business in New Zealand.
How did that come about?
there was advertising in the paper for people to, software programmers full-time. And I thought, I'll just write in and see if they've got any part-time work. And person responded, and I got off with my first customer. And then from one customer, you go to two, three, four. And so that was kind of my first business.
Wow.
Certainly paid better than the paper run.
Oh, I bet it did. So you went from a paper run to doing software development.
Yep.
Yeah. And what sort of clients were you working with?
There was a mixture of different clients. There was a company doing kind of home security, burglar alarm systems, and they'd moved across into bigger building kind of management systems. There was another one doing signs, like electronic signage. And there was a few others.
Oh, that's cool. Is there anything that really captured you at that stage in terms of, what was the thing that you really enjoyed about it?
I think both then and now, I love building things. And so it doesn't really matter whether it's building something physical, like a building, that's fascinating to me, or a business, which is another virtual thing, or software. And it just, I think, happens that software is something that it's very efficient format for building. So you can build things, tear them down, rebuild them, make them better, in a way that's hard in the physical world or in the business world.
Right. And so after that, you studied at some point. Did you keep doing sort of software development during your studying time?
When I went to university, I did electrical engineering, and I chose that over computer science because I'd already done a lot of software stuff. And so I felt like I was going to learn more if I went with a hardware-oriented kind of electronic engineering than going the computer science route.
And that's been pretty important in what you've ended up doing, I suppose.
Maybe. I don't know if it really mattered too much one way or another. After I graduated from Auckland University, I took a scholarship at a university in Australia. And it was at that point I moved across looking at kind of networking and communications from both a software and hardware perspective. And I think either background would have worked out fine for that next step.
Right. So how long did you spend in Australia? Because you have a doctorate now. That usually takes a fair period of time.
Yeah, I spent about 3 years in Australia doing my doctorate. And that was a pretty fun time. And it's when I first got into networking, as in computer networking.
Yeah. Now, what was it that drove you to do that extra study rather than maybe going out into the workforce a bit sooner?
One is I already had that business on the side. So I already had a business where I was making money when I was in New Zealand. And so I thought, well, while I've got this, I may as well do a little bit of extra study. So I was doing my master's at Auckland when the scholarship came through. And to be honest with you, I looked at the amount of the scholarship and it was like a salary. And I thought, wow, I can actually do a PhD and get paid a salary at the same time. This seems like a good deal. So it was an easy decision.
Yeah, that's pretty helpful. And when you finished up your doctorate, mm-hmm. and were looking for what the next step was, what did that look like for you? What were your options?
Yeah, well, that... I had three kind of choices at that point, three job offers, all from the same company, but one of them was to stay in Australia, another one was to move to Canada where that company was based, and the third one was to go work for that company in Tokyo in Japan. And so those were the three options I had.
That's a pretty interesting set of choices. So how did you make the decision?
Well, the first one I discarded was the Japan one because in high school, languages, I did French and Latin, they were my worst subjects by far. So I didn't really have any interest in Japan, and certainly I was fairly sure that learning Japanese would be really hard for me. So I discarded that option. I was looking at the other two. But at the same time, from that point, I started actually paying attention to things about Japan. And as it happened, they came back around to me 6 weeks later and asked me again, we know you said you didn't want to go to Japan, but have you thought any more about it? And I said the second time around, yes. And what had changed in that time is I thought about things and realized that going and working in Tokyo for a couple of years was going to be probably a much steeper learning curve. I'd learn a lot more. It would be a much more interesting experience. And that... kind of regardless, if you kind of looked at where you were in 2 years, that probably that was going to be the most interesting and give me that experience I was looking for.
Mm. So who was this company that was chasing you?
That was, in those days, it was called Northern Telecom, and then they contracted their name to Nortel. And then about 10, 15 years later, they went bankrupt, so they no longer exist. But for a while, they had their heyday.
Mm. Yes, I remember hearing of their demise. Now, what was that time like for you in Japan?
Well, it was every day something bizarre would happen. That's the most interesting thing about it.
Tell us one of those things.
One interesting story is I went out, had some friends visiting from New Zealand, and we went out and at the end of the night, we met up with some random people at the soup restaurant. So they said that we should try this particular noodle soup. And we ate it and everything. And I wrote down the name of it. And we got home. And so I looked up to find out what the soup was. And it was raccoon dog soup. So that you think, oh man, we ate a raccoon dog soup.
What?
Yep. Well, I told this story many times in Japan, probably for the next 3 to 6 months. It was one of my stories I told my Japanese friends. And then eventually one of my friends told me, Japanese friend, said, you know about the raccoon dog soup? There's no raccoon dog in it. And I go, why didn't you guys tell me this? And they go, yeah, there's no raccoon dog in it. It's the soup that raccoon dogs like. Ever after that, I'm kind of like, when someone tells me about a soup in Japan, I'm trying to figure out if it's got that thing in it or it's just the soup that that particular animal likes.
Yeah.
And then what it turns out there is another one, is a fox soup. That's also that's got no fox in it. It's a soup that a fox likes. But I think chicken soup has chicken in it.
I would hope so.
So those are the kind of experiences that happened all the time. And that was actually a lot of fun.
And how did you get on with the language?
Better than I thought. I found that when I was immersed in the culture there, that I was much more motivated to learn than I was studying languages in high school, and so made better progress.
What motivated you?
Just wanting to talk to people and get around. There's just the everyday necessities of life, and then also wanting to communicate.
That's good. And so how long did you end up staying in Japan?
2 years. That was pretty much the agreement when I went over there. And after that, you know, I needed to think about what to do next. And of course, staying in Japan, I could have done that, but it was, I think, a good amount of time.
What was next?
Well, as I looked at my options from Japan, I figured that it made most sense to kind of, at this point, I'd moved around Auckland to Sydney to Tokyo. And I thought, I really don't want to have to keep moving all the time for the rest of my life. So, you know, I'd always looked at Silicon Valley and thought, wow, that'd be great to work there. Mountain View, Cupertino, saw all these names of places on the boxes when I unpacked computers and thought, wow, why didn't I try and get a job over there? So I sent applications to half a dozen companies and got some responses, came over here, interviewed, and had a couple of offers, and chose to join a company called Stratacom.
What was it about Stratacom that attracted you? Because they weren't a massive name at that stage?
No. So they, when I joined, they were about 250 people. They're a public company. They just, shortly after I joined, celebrated their first kind of $100 million 12-month trailing number. And I joined them because the technology that they had developed was closely related to what I'd studied in my PhD and what I'd been working on in Japan. But one thing that really attracted me, to tell you the truth, was when I went and interviewed with them, they had no PhDs. They didn't know a lot about the theory of what was called at the time ATM networking, or synchronous transfer mode. It's a long gobbledygook name for it, networking. They had kind of stumbled into the area from a different direction, and they were doing things really differently. When I looked at what they had done, I thought, wow, this is really different. They've really got something here different than any other player in this space at the time. And so I thought they had a really good shot at success, and they'd be a great company to work for. What they were looking for is someone with more of a theoretical background in the area so that they could explain to people why their stuff worked. They knew it worked from trial and error, but they didn't know why it worked. And so one of the things I did is spend quite a bit of time with their potential service provider customers, explaining the product and working with the engineering team to, you know, build a second generation of that technology.
So that sounds like a pretty cool opportunity to come in as someone that had very unique skills that were quite different to what the business had. What came out of that time at Stratacom? Did you manage to see that through in terms of the next generation of the technology, and where did it go?
Yeah, absolutely. I saw it. We kind of went through two or three iterations of technology, but what happened was, I joined it. We were about 250 people. 2 years later, we were 1,500 people. The revenue had gone up by a factor of about four. And we were acquired by Cisco for $4 billion, which was, even today, that's a big amount. But in that time, it was kind of a record. And those 2 years were incredibly exciting. The company grew really, really fast. And, you know, you get to see that mixture of excitement and at the same time stress that comes from dealing with that kind of hypergrowth. But it was really fun time, and I learned a lot about what works and what doesn't work in that kind of environment.
So was it crazy hours that you were working with that, you know, the pressures of that growth? What did the actual working environment look like? I mean, we hear of, you know, some companies in the Valley that you know, have quite crazy ways of operating, and the stories of people sleeping under desks and early days of Microsoft and the like. What did it look like for you? Was it a little bit more normal than that?
It was more normal than that. Yeah. So I think those stories are true, probably, but more of an exception than the norm. So, you know, most people work relatively long hours, but not unduly long hours, and most people don't sleep under their desks. And certainly that's in the companies good. I've been involved with, I don't think we've had that happening.
Yeah, that's good. So what did you learn from the leadership? Tell us about the CEO and the founders of the business.
Back at Stratacom?
Yeah.
So the CEO of that company, his name was Dick Moley, and I think he did a great job of leading the company during that time, and in particular, choosing the right point to sell at. I remember the day I learned we were sold, which was basically the weekend before it was announced on Monday, and I was in some ways disappointed because we'd been on a meteoric rise.
Yes.
At that point. And when you're in the middle of that kind of whirlwind, you never see the end coming. You just think it's going to continue to go and go and go. And, you know, I think that Dick Moley realized that it was more advantageous for us to be part of Cisco because IP networking was beginning to take off, and it was the right time for us to become part of something bigger. And, you know, that was a decision that at the time puzzled me, but probably 1 or 2 years later, I realized that it was a very good decision.
Now, what sort of impact did that have on the team? Because often with these sorts of acquisitions, you've got a lot of team members that are shareholders, and they've had stock options, and they can end up doing quite well out of an acquisition. Did that mean that you had a bunch of people, you know, leave within a period of time, or did you leave? How did it look? How long did you stick around?
So I stuck around for 4 years. So I stayed with Cisco from 96 through to 2000. That happens to coincide with that term of most people's options, kind of the 4 years of golden handcuffs.
Right.
The way we talk about it.
Yes.
So, you know, I think it depends on the person. There are certainly people that left earlier, but in that kind of environment, you're leaving a lot on the table when you leave. So,
And that was a period where Cisco was doing quite well,
yes.
Also, wasn't it?
So yeah, Cisco did it very, very well after they bought us. And so for most people, it made sense to stay. But, you know, I think for some people, and myself included, there's always the desire to do something on your own. And so, you know, as we talked at the beginning, I started out with that contract programming business, my own business. And I'd, through that whole time here in Silicon Valley, been thinking about doing something myself. That was kind of always in the back of my mind. And so I wasn't going to stay at Cisco forever. But that was a really good time to be there. It was probably the most successful period in Cisco's history, the late 90s. And it was really when, you know, the web came along and took off, and the internet became the network that it is today. It was in the 90s that transformed things.
Yes. So huge period of growth. So how big was Cisco at the time that you joined? Because they must have, you know, been growing pretty rapidly during that that period, and they must have had sort of similar challenges, but at a bigger scale than what Stratacom had been dealing with, I guess, in terms of growth.
Yeah, you know, I don't remember the exact numbers, but what I do remember is that Cisco was about 10 times bigger than Stratacom.
Right.
And so we were about a tenth of the company after the acquisition. So if you use that math, Cisco bought us for $4 billion, so they must have been, by that math, about $40 billion. But you'd need to go back and check.
Yeah.
But that gives you a rough order of magnitude. And then they grew very rapidly in the 90s. And I think, you know, at the end of the 90s, year 2000, they were worth nearly $500 million. So they definitely, you know, ramped up a lot during that time.
Now,
$500 trillion, actually.
Yeah, I was thinking, hold on.
$500 billion. Yeah. Dropped a few zeros there.
Now, what were the things that you learned around how, I guess, acquisitions can be successful or not successful? You know, how well did that sort of process go in terms of Stratacom becoming part of Cisco? Because it must have been quite a different environment. I don't know how different the cultures were. There must be a few lessons along that way, whether they've been useful to you or not, I don't know.
Yeah, I've never really been on the acquiring side.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that Cisco actually did, especially in that period of time, did a lot of acquisitions. And relative to their peers, they did a pretty good job of managing those acquisitions. But it was also a crazy time, and so there were lots of acquisitions that were made that ended up, you know, the products that the people were working on never really made it to market. Now, Stratacom, it actually worked out pretty well. And our business unit went on to, you know, contribute billions of dollars to the pie.
Pretty successful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was it enjoyable for you to be working within the business of Cisco, or, you know, compared to how it was previously? How did you sort of find that, the change, or did you operate quite in a fairly similar manner?
You know, it's quite a while ago, but
yeah.
You know, I did enjoy that time. One of the things I did when I was at Cisco is I took the opportunity to move over from engineering into product management and marketing. And
okay.
So got to see the business from a different perspective. And, you know, I think one of the pieces of advice I have for people that are acquired and working in a big company like Cisco is it's actually a good opportunity to kind of move laterally and learn more about the way a business is run and get a better kind of overall perspective of things. Because when you're in a big company like that, you know, there's a lot of things that you can learn. And so, you know, that's my advice to people that are working in a big company like that.
That's great. Were there any big takeaways for you from that time? Anything that stands out now looking back that's really helped you shape and you know, mold what you've built in more recent years?
Yeah, I can't think of any one particular thing, but you know, obviously there were so many things that I learned back in those days, and they're all part of part of what.
Yeah, it all feeds in, doesn't it? All that experience. So you exited Cisco about 2000.
Mm-hmm.
What were the triggers, and what did you end up doing next?
So I met a team of people that were working on some really cool laser technology, and they had developed a laser which you could tune. So if it was it's an infrared laser for communications, but if it was invisible, like, it would be like you could tune it like a rainbow.
Okay.
And that had some pretty big implications for optical networking, and that was an area that was taking off at the time. And so I decided to join that team and build a system around that tunable laser.
Okay. And was that a success at all?
No.
No.
Well, you know, there's a mixed success there. But, you know, at that, what happened is I left Cisco at a very opportune time, because in the late year 2000, the whole tech market crashed. And in particular, there was a big bubble that had built up in communications and in optical networking. And so Cisco went down, but it also meant that for the startup I joined, we were in the optical networking space, and it became very hard for anyone to be successful. And so we spent a year developing our first product and got it ready for trials. And then we realized that pretty much all of our customers who were carriers were in trouble and really couldn't buy any more equipment. And so we needed to look at how did we shift that business and focus on a different area.
And what was your role in the business?
So I was a general manager for the systems part of the business. So there's two pieces, basically the component side and then the system side. Yeah, I built a team, built a product in a year, and then we basically had to find new homes for everybody in other companies because that didn't work out.
Wow. So how stressful was that? Because that must be a somewhat – there are certainly aspects of that that are somewhat common in the startup world.
Yep.
But it must have brought with it a fair deal of pressure.
Definitely pressure. But you know, one of the things I'm proud of from that time is that, you know, a lot of the people that I'd hired and who joined and worked with me there, they came back to work for me later. So I didn't burn all the bridges. And you know, I did have some other friends and other startups that were basically hiring at the same time that we were shrinking, and so a lot of them moved over to work for those companies. And I think in Silicon Valley, for every company that's on the kind of downhill slope, there's some that are on the uphill slope. And so there's quite a bit of mobility and usually not too hard for people to find another opportunity.
That's great. What was next after that?
So after that, I joined a venture capital company called Benchmark and worked there for a year as an entrepreneur in residence.
How did that come about?
It came about the way it usually comes about. So in the previous company that hadn't done so well, two of the investors in that company were Benchmark and Greylock. And through that, I'd met the board members from Greylock and Benchmark. And that led indirectly to my work at Benchmark.
Mm. And what did that role look like?
Yeah, so in that time, you know, most venture capital companies had this role. Different venture companies had different ideas of what it meant, but for Benchmark, it was more about just providing an office space and an opportunity for you to come up with an idea that perhaps they could fund. And so that's essentially what I did. I had several different ideas that I explored, and one of them became my current company, Silver Peak.
Okay, so they obviously had a fairly high opinion of you, a lot of confidence in terms of your abilities to come up with something that was going to make sense.
I guess so.
Yeah, that's cool. Did you have those ideas before you went in? Were you, you know, did you
Not
have
really,
to sort of
no,
pitch
I,
a whole lot to them? Or
No. I actually took 6 months off. That was the first kind of, and actually only long time I took off, but yeah. I spent quite a bit of time back in New Zealand, actually, those 6 months, and then came back refreshed and joined Benchmark to kind of work on a variety of different ideas. But I didn't really have any of them lined up beforehand.
Mm.
A few of the ideas were in their really initial stages.
So that brings us to Silver Peak.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about founding Silver Peak and that process of developing the idea and seeking funding. Obviously, you had some good connections on that front, from the outset.
Yeah, so I started Silver Peak in 2004, and you know the two companies, Benchmark and Greylock, that I'd worked with before, funded my Series A and got us off and running.
And now, when you go through those sorts of things, did you have to, in this case, go out to a lot of other partners, or did you, because you had those relationships established, you didn't need to, you know, seek funding more broadly?
I spoke to a handful of other companies, other investment companies at the time, but not a lot.
Hmm. So what is Silver Peak all about? What was the idea that made it worthwhile you committing your time to founding the business and Greylock and Benchmark investing in making that happen?
So, this is 2004, I started Silver Peak. We're now, 13 years on. And so Silver Peak really has two stages. There's the current business that we're in, and then there's where we started. So maybe I'll answer your question about, you know, when we started. Does that make sense? And
that's
then I'll kind of walk you through if it makes sense, if you're how we evolved to where we are today. So when I started the company, we were focused on how to move data more efficiently between different locations that an enterprise might have, between their data centers or between their branches in the data center, or as it grew, between the data center and the cloud a bit later on.
Right. And this was a time where internet bandwidth was fairly constrained compared to what we have today, right? People didn't have very fast internet connections. They didn't have very fast, I guess, wide area network connections to link branches together. So technology that could improve that was going to be fairly valuable.
Yeah, so a lot of it focused around reducing the amount of information that had to be sent by either compressing the data or by realizing, you know, in a lot of cases that the data that you were trying to send had already been sent before. So an email, you know, when you do a reply to, there's the whole reply to thread. Maybe that's already on the other side of the network effectively. And so you don't need to send those things again. And so that kind of deduplication technology and compression and a variety of other things that you could do to make protocols work better over the wide area network. That was our initial focus at Silver Peak, and was sufficient for us to build a self-sustaining business.
You mentioned building a self-sustaining business. How long did that take to get to that that point?
Roughly 5 years. I think for the first 5 years, we needed to go out multiple times to seek extra funding. But by the end of the 2000s, 2009, 2010, we had a business that could support itself.
Great. Now, coming into that space, what did it look like? Were there others that had somewhat similar ideas? Was there a competitor to disrupt? What was the lay of the land?
So when we started in 2004, 2005, if you look at kind of around 2005, it was actually a pretty hot space, and we had a number of competitors. But, you know, 3, 4, 5 years later, the market had consolidated. There was one company, Riverbed, who had become number one. Cisco, because they usually participate in these things, was number two. And I think from a technology point of view, and probably also from a market share point of view, the next one was our Silver Peak. And we, because we weren't number one overall, we focused on winning in niches or, building a stronghold. And for us, that stronghold was around data center to data center optimization. And so helping people move huge amounts of data between their core data centers or between those data centers and the cloud.
Right. So that would be fairly sizable chunks of business when you would win it, I would imagine,
yes,
in those sort of situations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had customers that spent, cumulatively tens of millions of dollars on our technology, like a single company. So that kind of gives you an idea of the scale.
Yep. And how big were you at that stage when you had reached profitability?
I don't have all those things, all the exact numbers, but, somewhere between 100 and 150 people.
Right, right. And now you talked about a second stage of the business.
Mm-hmm.
What happened between that sort of point of breaking even and getting to that that second stage of the business? What did that look like?
When you're competing, I often think about it in terms of sailing, because I like sailing as well. And if you're the yacht that's behind, you're always wanting to split and head off to the other side of the course. Not just any time, but at the right time when the picking the wind shifts.
Of course.
And so, I think about when you're running a company and you're competing in a very similar way. And so you need to pick one or two things to do differently. And it's what you pick, when you pick it, that makes a big difference. And so we did a few different things over the life of the company. So one of the first big shifts we picked was this idea of focusing on a data center. And I'd say, one of the reasons why Silver Peak's still around today, and we didn't become one of the, 10 other companies that we were competing with at the beginning there in 2005, that went away was because we successfully picked that shift. And the data center to data center business was a reasonable fraction of the total WAN optimization market, and we just focused on being the biggest and fastest and best for that particular part of the market.
But how hard was it to make that call to you know, niche down in a way and maybe, you know, have less chance of getting, you know, picking up some other aspects of the market?
It's actually really hard because you're always seeing customers that want you to do all these other things, and they've got real money. But if it's something that your competitor does as well, then they're bigger than you, in the long term, it's hard to catch up. Just like when you're sailing, if you've got a one design boat, if you're behind, it's going to be hard to pass just following along in exactly the same track. So it's not actually easy to say no to some business so that you can focus on becoming really good at that one thing you've picked. But that was very important. That particular decision, I think, was important in terms of our survival.
How did you make it? Who else was involved in that picture? Because for quite a period, you had a CEO in the business. You weren't leading the business yourself as well. You've got investors. So that's, you know, can you walk us
Those
through that?
Kind of decisions are made as a team. Mm. And so you're right, actually. For the first 8-odd years of the company, I was the chief technology officer. I hired someone to run the company as CEO. I took over as CEO about 4 years ago. But to your question, those kind of decisions are a joint team decision. And I think there's always a lot of discussion. And, you know, I don't think it's so much a debate around should you focus or not. It's more about which thing do you focus on and when.
But that worked out reasonably well for you by the sounds of it.
It did. And, you know, I think moving on a couple more years, around 2010, it was clear that virtualization was becoming really important in the enterprise, and that there was an opportunity for us to move from being kind of a software running on hardware with a hardware delivery business to more of a pure software business.
Right. So you were selling a physical product. People would, you know, buy it from you. You had to provide some sort of warranty on that equipment and so on.
Yeah.
To very much a software offering that would run on whatever technology systems they were running.
That's right. So we moved to aggressively provide our technology as pure software. We've always kept the hardware models around because some people prefer to buy that way. But it was because we moved to a pure software environment, we learned a lot about things going on in networking, something called software-defined networking. And, you know, a lot of what people are doing in the cloud, everything that's in the cloud is virtualized effectively if you're using, say, Amazon, AWS, Amazon Web Services. And so that was a pretty important decision. It let us grow the business and make the business a lot more profitable because the software business, you know, it can be a lot more profitable than a hardware business.
And you were a pretty quick mover in that direction, weren't you? Because you mentioned Riverbed before, who were the other player in that space. Were they doing that first, or were you a bit quicker there?
I think they had a much bigger business, so anything they did takes much longer to move. We within a year or two had gotten to the point where more than half of the units that we were selling were software, and I don't think any other competitor came even close to that.
Right, and were you able to sell the software product at a similar price to the hardware product you'd had before, but without supplying the hardware, or was there a big price differential?
We made it relatively neutral for customers to decide which way they wanted to do it, whichever made sense to them. We didn't try to pull them one way or another with pricing.
Right, but it certainly took a lot of complexity, I guess, out for you.
Yes. Yeah. And then, you know, I think most importantly, it put us in a position where we were learning and able to see the next big shift that came, which really gets us to the second generation of Silver Peak, if you think about it that way. You know, we were talking to customers and they were sharing the challenges they were having with their cloud deployments where they were hosting their own applications in the cloud, or where they were using cloud-based services like Office 365 or Salesforce. And they were asking, could our WAN optimization technology help with those problems? And at the same time, there were things happening in the data center that we were privy to, because that was our core market. And we realized that some of the techniques that were being used in the data center to build overlays to segment traffic could be used in the wide area network where we were focused. And so in response to that, we began developing and improving on some of the techniques that we had to make it really easy for customers to build a enterprise network over the top of any kind of underlying technology, so that they could build a network that leveraged standard enterprise networking, goes by an acronym called MPLS. They could use the internet, buy broadband and get the bandwidth cost advantages from that. Or they could use wireless connectivity like 4G or in the future 5G, LTE, and be able to build a network that kind of would let you virtualize the underlying transport and deliver whatever was needed by that customer over the top. And that that segment's now called SD-WAN, or software-defined wide area networking. And we are a leader in that space. We launched a new product called Edge Connect to address this a couple of years ago, and it's been a really exciting couple of years.
Now, when you say a leader, I guess there are different ways that these things get defined, but in the tech world, there's Gartner, who often gets referenced.
Yep.
Is that where you're landing in their?
Yeah. So historically, for the first business that we had, WAN optimization, for the last four or five Gartner Magic Quadrants, we were in the so-called leaders quadrant, which is the best quadrant to be in, the top right.
Of course.
There's no magic quadrant yet for this new area around SD-WAN or the WAN edge.
Right.
I think most of the companies competing besides Cisco are private companies, so there's not a lot of data to measure leadership.
Yeah.
But, I think some of the things that, some of the ways of measuring are looking at things like customer counts. So we've gone from, in our first year, we won and deployed about 100 customers. We've recently kind of crossed the threshold where we have 500 paying deployed customers. So more than quadrupling
from year on year,
from year over year. Yeah.
That's great.
So it's enormous growth. And, I think when you look at others, it's not really anybody else, or certainly only one or two others that are growing at anything like that rate.
Oh, that's a pretty exciting position to be in. So what is it like for you now, leading the firm that's got such big growth? What sort of things have you had to change in terms of how you lead the business?
I think that, the main thing we need to focus on now is, how do we prepare for continued growth? And so, we've been hiring and looking at, what do we need to do to support growth? And, what would be really exciting if it was growth like what we saw back in the early days at Stratacom, where we went from there was 250 to 1,500 employees in the space of 2 years. It would be really exciting to be faced with that same kind of stretch challenge. We'll wait and see.
So you are at around 250 people now?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So there might be some similarities.
At least that's a similarity. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are the big lessons that you've learned along the way in this journey that you could share? What things sort of when you look back have helped define your success, that have helped you with making good decisions, good hires?
Yeah, I think that the from a point of view of building a team in any company, the people you hire are really important. And so even though we have 250 employees, I generally try to interview every single person we're hiring. Now, that can't go on forever. That won't scale. But I do think that building the team is a really, really important part of being successful. Now, that's not the only ingredient, but it's one ingredient. I think from a product point of view, finding product market fit and being able to learn quickly from your customers and from your deployments and adapt, because no one's perfect out of the gate. You have to kind of continually look at how do you improve, how do you adapt to changes. The faster you can do that, the more likely you are to put distance between yourself and the competition. And so, you know, that's always what I'm looking at. Do we have an environment where we are getting feedback, where we're listening, where are we learning, and then how fast are we adapting to what we've learned? And, you know, often people confuse listening with doing. Often customers have ideas that, to be honest, are not the best idea for them or for us, but they're asking for something because there's some other, you know, ask a couple more whys, and you'll find out that, yeah, there's a real problem there, but there's a better way of solving it. And so that learning step is really important, and having an organization that's built to learn is, I think, important.
So how do you create that sort of feedback loop, and especially as your team grows, so that you're able to be plugged into particularly the useful feedback that's coming through from your customers? How closely do you stay connected to that?
Me personally? So I do, at this size of businesses, I do stay pretty close to our kind of product management decisions. You know, I think that the hard part is actually saying no. There's lots and lots of ideas your customers have and lots of feature requests that come in, and there's many things that you could see would be potentially a good idea, but you can't do them all. First, because you've only got limited resources. But the other thing is, if you implement every idea that everybody has, you end up with a super complicated product. And one of the ideas behind this SD-WAN movement is making things really simple. Networking's gotten to be such an alphabet soup of acronyms. You need people with, you know, multiple years of training and studying to get certifications to manage these networks. That seems kind of wrong in an age where we're on the cusp of having self-driving cars. And so although this SD-WAN stands for software-defined WAN, I tell people, you know, it should really be self-driving WAN. And where we need to get to is a WAN that manages itself. So there's elements of automation, there's elements of machine learning and artificial intelligence that go into that. But part of it is, you know, less features and less knobs. When you jump in the self-driving car of the future, you just tell them where you want to go. You don't need to have a dashboard with a million different things that you can control. That's like an aircraft. That's not the future of networking, in my opinion. It's certainly where we've been, but not where we're going. And I've kind of diverged a bit, but back to the you know, product management decisions. It's always, to me, it's a discipline of deciding what you don't do. And then maybe the picking the one or two things that you really choose to double down on.
And I mean, how do you go through making those decisions, or is it something that becomes pretty clear and pretty obvious to you as you look at the, you know, the huge amounts of feedback that that you must get over a period of time? There are particular things that sort of jump out quite naturally. Do you have to draw on a lot of data?
Yeah, you know, I think those things, it's hard to say exactly what goes on in your own mind or in the team's mind in terms of making those decisions. But it's about listening to what people are trying to do and why they're trying to do it, and then thinking about what's the smallest number of things that you could do that would have the biggest impact. You know, I think it, back to the sailing analogy, it's a bit like when you have to pick those wind shifts. Sometimes you're going to be right, sometimes you're going to be wrong. Trying to explain to somebody else exactly why you did something in a particular situation, it's all going so fast, and it's sort of it's not easy to step back and say, this is exactly why we did this. But
I guess there's a fair degree of intuition and just drawing on all of your previous lessons, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, how important has it been for you to be based here in Silicon Valley? You could have, you know, easily learnt a few things, and then, you know, you mentioned coming back to New Zealand for a period there of 6 months. It would have been easy for you to set yourself up in the comfort of New Zealand and tried to export to the world, but you've been right here in the midst of really what is the focal point, I guess, for a lot of the tech industry. Has that been quite critical to your success, you think?
Yeah, that's a little bit hard to say, a bit hypothetical. Mm. But, you know, I think that Silicon Valley is unique in the world in terms of having this massive pool of very capable people and kind of this continual creative destruction where companies are going out of business, there's new ones arising, and so that creates this kind of ecosystem. And that's certainly the ecosystem that I'm most familiar with, having worked here now for most of my life. But, you know, I follow what happens in New Zealand pretty closely. And, you know, I'd love to see New Zealand's technology industry continue to grow. And I don't think there's any reason why, you know, people in New Zealand cannot be successful. In fact, you kind of look, now there's a few success stories. And, you know, I think that in terms of thinking differently and choosing to not go where everybody else is going, choose that thing you want to double down on that's different than the others, I think people in New Zealand are actually pretty good at doing that. And that's certainly one of the ingredients that's needed. Now, having a big, huge base of potential employees like Silicon Valley has, it's, New Zealand doesn't have quite that advantage, but there's no reason that can't be overcome.
Yeah, I think so. And there's certainly a bit of a draw card, I think, in the current times to New Zealand, where people, you know, find it a pretty cool place to be. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hopefully that sort of interest continues, because sometimes for our local tech companies, we can find the right expertise locally, but sometimes you do need to tap into that bigger mm-hmm. pool, which I guess has been you know, certainly an asset for the specialized nature of the business you've yeah. been in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got a big pool that's on tap.
Yeah.
Anything else that you can share from your journey that people might find interesting? Where to from here?
You know, right now I'm really focused on winning in this SD-WAN market and becoming the leader, and so that's what I'm looking at. And you know, I think the next 1 or 2 years are going to be really, really exciting.
Good. Well, best of luck, David. It's great to hear your story, and we'll look forward to seeing how things grow for the business. I liked your analogy there about your business and about delivering, I guess, the equivalent of the self-driving car to the networking world. And I can imagine there are lots of people listening that like that thought of technology that can actually run itself. And I certainly believe that that's the sort of future that we should expect. There's been a lot of complexity around technology and lots of expertise that's been required to, you know, tweak settings and adjust things and to troubleshoot things. And we should actually be able to get to a point where the technology is actually monitoring itself and is able to take care of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's this big shift in all industries, but in networking is where I'm focused, where instead of configuring all these detailed things, if you come back, step back for a second, when a CIO or a business unit leader looks at the network, they have some high-level intent for the network. They want it to carry voice calls with no clicks, no dropped calls. They want the video conferencing to work smoothly. They want the virtual desktop infrastructure. You know, they don't want screens freezing up or keystrokes being dropped. That's the kind of thing that they're thinking of. They want the apps to be available and not be down in the middle of the day. That they want their backups to get completed. That's what people want the network for. And so the idea of a self-driving network is that you capture that intent for the network and then everything else is automated. And now there's a few steps between where we are today and getting to that point, but we've made in the last couple of years really big strides. And I think, yeah, in a lot of cases we're looking at, in a lot of industries, looking at how do you use technology to make people's lives easier and get us out of having to worry about all those details and give us more time to focus on kind of higher level important things. Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly, you know, in my field, running a technology services firm, it's certainly, you know, been part of my view that that's the way the industry, our industry will head, in that the idea of you know, technicians having to run around and you know, figure out why somebody can't print, and you know, there's all sorts of little things that get that have to be dealt with at that simple level, at a networking level, and so on, that actually should be able to be automated out of you know, existence from a work perspective over time. And as you say, that provides an opportunity to be focusing on the things that matter more to the success of the business.
Yeah, and even in terms of that kind of break fix IT organization. I mean, today, many IT organizations are overwhelmed by all of these trouble tickets and alarms that are going off. Sometimes there's just one underlying cause. And so they're running around under a lot of stress trying to figure out why are all these people complaining, to find that one thing that's wrong. And actually, you know, computers, and especially with artificial intelligence, are really good at sifting through all of that, correlating the information, and coming up with, hey, here's the three things that are broken that you need to go fix. And so it, I think, can lead to, you know, let IT people get their lives back so that they don't have to be called back into work on the weekend or after work to fix problems. And so it's a good thing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good things about, you know, where we're heading with this type of technology with AI and automation. Do you have any sort of broader views on the longer term as we automate a lot more systems, and, you know, what the impact could be on varying roles disappearing?
Yeah, you know, I think that's been a theme through all of probably human history, and certainly through period of industrialization, that the people's jobs evolve. But, you know, people are always worried about what's going to happen in the next wave, but things seem to work themselves out. And so, you know, I think if we are making people's lives easier and less stressful, it's probably a good thing.
So you don't think we're all going to be down to 10 or 20 hours a week anytime soon? You think there's going to be enough work to keep us all pretty busy?
Yeah, not my specialty, predicting the future.
Well, I think you've done all right at figuring things out so far.
Yeah, but, you know, I think that certainly there could be a reduction in the amount of hours people need to work. There'll be more time for leisure. I don't know if it gets down to 10 or 20 hours, and, you know, I don't know over what time period that happens, but, yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
Great. All right, well, thank you very much for your time, David.
Okay, great thank to you. Talk to you, Paul.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that one as much as I did. It was certainly a great privilege for me to get a chance to sit down and catch up with David Hughes again and to hear his story, and quite an exclusive one at that. I don't think there's really been a lot of coverage of David in the New Zealand media, but he has got an incredible story and has achieved so much, and looks like his business, Silver Peak Systems, is really going from strength to strength there in Silicon Valley. A special thanks to our two sponsors, Process Street. Of course, Process Street is the platform that my team at Gorilla use to deliver much more consistent results than what we were able to in the past with online electronic checklists for our business processes, supported by as much or as little documentation as you need, whether that's video, training material, or written documentation, but incredibly helpful. It's also the tool that's allowed me to move into a much more strategic role in the business and have less involvement in some of the operational things that used to tie me up in the past. It's much easier for me to see what's going on and to monitor that we're delivering at the right standard, getting the right outcomes without myself having to be so deeply involved in all of those things. So an incredible platform, thoroughly recommend it. If you want to see how Process Street might help your business, then you can get access to it, nzbusinesspodcast.com/processstreet. You'll get access to a 10% discount for life, as well as a free version that gives you the ability to create up to 5 processes for your business. And of course, a special thanks to the team at Gorilla Technology, Gorilla being the other sponsor for the New Zealand Business Podcast. And look, if you need any help with how your organization should leverage technology better, then certainly get in touch, and we'd be more than happy to talk with you, whether it's simple things such as how to move your business systems from servers and to modernize and to get those systems into the cloud, or whether you're looking at some level of digital transformation, making your team more efficient, more effective, using technology, any of those things, then we can help you out. So find us at gorillatechnology.com. All right, well, thanks everybody for joining me. We'll catch you on the next episode of the New Zealand Business Podcast. And we do have some fascinating interviews coming up over the coming episodes. We've got one with the CEO at Yellow in New Zealand, something of their story and of transformation, and a bunch more coming too. All right, see you soon. Bye.
The New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Gorilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.